Hello, and welcome to another Sarasota Institute podcast. The Sarasota Institute is a 21st century think tank that is focused on 10 major topics we feel important for the future of humanity. Please go to sarasotainstitute.global to learn more. The Sarasota Institute is a nonprofit corporation.
Hi, welcome to the Sarasota Institute podcast. First of all, very special thanks is owed to our members. Thanks very much. I'm Jason Apollo-Voss, co-founder, and joining us today is my fellow co-founder, David Houle. You may also know that he's the author of This Spaceship Earth, and I think he's an overall Renaissance person. David, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure to be here, Jason. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So I know that this is a subject near and dear to you, and over various coffees and lunches and other shared experiences, you've said that doing something about climate, you would love to be a part of your legacy. So lots of people talk about climate change. What's your unique view of it?
Well, you know, as you know, I'm a futurist, and I've written books about the future of education, the future of branding. And so being a guest lecturer at the Ringling College of Art and Design, as well as being futurist in residence, I started guest lecturing in a classroom taught by Tim Rummage, professor and head of environmental studies at Ringling. And over a couple of years, I just realized that he was one of the wisest people I've met about climate change. So I asked him if he'd like to write a book, because I had one, that's what I wanted to do. So we co-authored the book, writing most of last part of 2014 and 2015. And in that 18-month period of writing the book, I became so alarmed, Jason, that I said, as a professional futurist, it would be a dereliction of my duty as such to not speak about climate change, because it's the single greatest existential threat facing humanity today. So with that, we wrote the book, The Spaceship Earth, which led to setting up a nonprofit, thespaceshipearth.org, to create crew consciousness. And so that, and then I started speaking around the country primarily on This Spaceship Earth, spoke at NASA, spoke at the EPA, and just felt that it was something that a futurist needed to address, because there's too many scientists talking too much science. So that's really the germination of becoming a climate change oriented futurist.
Yeah, definitely the germination, but it asks, what's your unique take on it? And I think I heard an element of it in there, which was crew consciousness, and that your take on it is that we need to change the mindset of people. Give us a little bit more detail on that and what you mean by that typically.
Yeah, so there are three things that humanity has to do to successfully face climate change. Number one is the only one that really gets talked about in media, which is reducing the use of fossil fuels to thereby reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's the first thing. The second thing is, since carbon stays up into the atmosphere for centuries, if not millennia, as we've put all this carbon up over the last 50 years, it stayed there. And so we've gone from 800 gigatons to 1,300 gigatons of resident CO2 in the atmosphere from 1980 to now, which is completely time congruent to the warming of the planet. So it is what we've already put up that's warming the planet, not what we're putting up today. So we need to stop using fossil fuels. We need to draw down the carbon that we've already put up into the atmosphere. And then the third thing you're referring to is we have to develop crew consciousness. The guiding phrase is from Marshall McLuhan, who around Earth Day in 1970 said, "There are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We are all crew." The example of crewness that I find is the easiest way to flip a person's switch in terms of consciousness is to ask them how much they pay their electric bill every month. And pretty much everybody knows that. And I'll ask an audience, I think Leap Your Look at Climate Change, I asked somebody in the front row, and they said it was $140 a month. And I said, okay, so as a consumer, one comes to paying an electric bill based on one's past experience. The average American spends $100 a month on energy. That's all they know. When you ask anyone how much energy they are paying for, they do not know. So a consumer approaches a monthly electric bill by price conditioning. A crew member will look at the bill and say, how can I reduce it? So for example, with this Spaceship Earth, we said the 2% solution. If you take the average, it's $100, it's 1,000 kilowatt hours a month. Take that down by 2%, so it's $980 the next month. On a constant 1,000, after 6 months, you'd be down to $880. And the only way you can do that is to manage your electricity, because most people who will listen to this podcast, electricity in the United States comes from fossil fuels. So if you consciously turn off lights, if you lower the thermostat in the winter and raise it in the summer, you do all those things, you are acting as crew because you're consciously, actively managing the energy you consume, no longer being conditioned to coming at it from a price-oriented consumer.
So I know one of the things that you spend quite a lot of time on, not a lot of folks who talk about climate change do, and the myriad reasons why mostly conversations about climate have to do with removing CO2 and other greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. It's because we haven't even gotten there yet. But one of the issues I know you speak about frequently, David, is how we draw down the amount of CO2 that is already in the atmosphere. And I know you've done a lot of research and reading about that subject. Give our audience a little bit of detail on some of the better news stories there that you found.
It's an early stage industry. There's a lot of biomimicry from nature. In other words, we know trees draw down CO2. So how can we manufacture artificial trees that draw down a multiple amount of in any single tree? And there's some early success there. There are a couple of different models out of Europe where in Germany, for example, they've put a particulate capture device on top of a tall building. And I think the radius is a kilometer. It can clean up it through a various technique. It captures and filters out the CO2 particulate and other greenhouse gas emissions particulates from the atmosphere. And then there's a couple in Netherlands, where it's kind of like, if you can imagine those columns of air purifiers you have in the house. Well, this is like a three-story one that can clean up the entire place or plots or large area, plaza of particulates. But the ability to draw it down, really, there needs to be some work draw it down from the upper atmosphere, because that's where planes are and everything else. So we need to do atmospheric cleansing. We need to capture CO2 from any place where it is. There's manufacturing going on, and then we need to reduce the particulates that we all breathe. It's not yet scalable, and that's the problem. But it will be, and that's one of the reasons, you know, and I'd like to talk about it, is this moving to a finite Earth economy, because given where we are relative to our ability to face this overwhelming issue, we really need to change we really need to reinvent capitalism in a way that addresses this. Capitalism is the single greatest force in human history for the creation of material well-being and affluence, as you well know. And also, we know that whatever, at least in the United States, when you tax something that's bad, you reduce its consumption. You know, cigarettes were known in 1964, Surgeon General, to cause death, right? You'd get cancer, but it didn't stop smoking. What stopped smoking was the two-step process of taking commercials for cigarettes off television, and then to also tax them. Same thing with seatbelts. We knew that seatbelts would save lives until it became the law. It didn't. So, for example, in order to even face the magnitude of climate change, take, for example, taxation on the state level. If you want to get rid of carbon, tax it. So instead of you and I paying an income tax, we'd pay a tax based on our carbon footprint. And the reason I'm bringing it up in answer to your question is that the only way to get to scale on any of these new industries, or the only way to get to scale in terms of ramping up of plug-in electric vehicles, is to make is to tax people so that you will create those markets. Nobody wants to pay more in taxes. So if you are putting out X tons as your carbon footprint of CO2 a year, you're going to get taxed on the tons. You get taxed on that. You kind of go, how do I offset my taxes? Well, I'll go get a credit because I'm buying an EV, or I'll write a check to a technology company that's working on atmospheric cleansing, or I'll write a check to carbon offsets. You know, people are planting trees, whatever, to lower my taxes. So I really don't think that this issue can be faced except at the highest level globally.
So switching gears slightly, talk to us about Earth Overshoot Day. I know that's something that you quote frequently whenever you're presenting about the subject.
Yeah, it's one of the problems we have is we can't accurately measure carbon. It's kind of an aggregate estimates. So what Earth Overshoot Day is, the aggregate estimates of extraction and consumption, extraction of goods from the earth to create what we as a consumer society want. So theoretically, the ideal Earth Overshoot Day would be midnight, December 31st. What that means is that it took a whole year for everything we extracted from the earth, and that the earth could regenerate. So Earth Overshoot Day is the day after which we overshoot the ability of the earth to reproduce or replicate or regenerate what we've taken. So for example, in early 70s, we started moving back from December 31st. So last year, 2019, Earth Overshoot Day was July 29. What that meant was that starting July 30th, we were extracting more from the earth relative to our consumer needs than the earth could replenish. The seriousness of it is the fact that we've been doing this for 50 years. So we've moved from December 30th down through December into November. Now we're down into July. And the aggregate of 4 decades of that means we have a whole deficit. One of the ways to think about it is, and you're a finance guy, is we've taken on the debt of the planet, and we have to pay that debt back. We've taken so much more out of the planet than it could possibly regenerate that we have to pay back that debt, hopefully in the same 50-year period, to get back to an equilibrium. So Earth Overshoot Day, you know, in the book Moving to a Finite Earth Economy, I laid out year by year by year, starting in 2021 through 2030, where Earth Overshoot Day should be. So basically, Earth Overshoot Day measures how much more we consume than the planet can replicate or reproduce or regenerate.
So far in our conversation today, you've talked about a couple of ideas for how we can alter the trajectory of climate change. What would you say, and concisely, of course, I wish we could dedicate more time to it, but it's one of those things where it's either short bites or it's...
Yeah, I'll do short bites from now on. I got the hint.
For the rest of your life. And actually, I think your answers are fine and concise, but in terms of what can we do differently, that could be a very long answer. What's your prescription for how we could alter the trajectory of climate change?
The first thing is to change the language. Language is what thoughts are made of. So if you change the language, you change the thinking. I always say that, I say two things. So to start with this language, we have left the time of denial, which is fighting people who are in denial that climate change is real. And we've entered the time of disconnection, which in effect is much more dangerous. So, for example, at the symposium on the Sarasota Institute symposium on climate change, I asked everybody to raise their hand if over the last 10 years they've become concerned with climate change. And given the profile of the audience, just about everybody raised their hands. I said, keep your hands up if you've ever bought an SUV in that 10-year period. And a lot of people kept their hands up. So in other words, that's a disconnection. I'm concerned about it, but I'm doing something in my life that exacerbates the problem. And so, you know, then I asked another question. Have you ever bought any new article of clothing in the last year that was either a spontaneous purchase or was based on fashion? And a lot of hands went up. Well, that's not helping climate change. I mean, it's fighting it. So, you know, one of the critical things is people who think they're green start to get self-righteous about it. Well, I recycle. Yeah, but do you always buy, do you not buy clothes? Do you buy secondhand? And that's where you get people. So we're in the age of disconnection between being concerned and actually living and acting with that concern. The second part of the language, and again, I did this with the audience at our climate change symposium. I said, raise your hand if you've ever used the phrase, save the planet. And of course, everybody raises their hand. And I kind of go, please, people, don't say that. It's the most anthropocentric statement you could make. The planet is fine. We're trying to save ourselves from ourselves. The planet has been around for 3 to 4 billion years. It's going to be around for 3 to 4 billion years more until the sun blows up. So the planet, we don't need to save the planet. Stop that. And it's kind of a meme that people use to show their environmental. And I just, as I was saying to you, I just traveled to Dallas and in that hotel, help us save the planet by not making us wash your towels. So it's a bogus phrase. Instead, we have to, climate change is nothing but the earth reacting to how humanity lives on it. So the climate's fine. It's just reacting to this invasive species called humanity. So instead of that, we have to say we have to save ourselves from ourselves, because it is living in growth economies that has created this problem and how we power those growth economies. And the important thing is, if we say we have to save ourselves from ourselves, it implies the accuracy of we've created the problem so we can create the solution. The magnitude of saving the planet is beyond any single species to do. So one, we've moved from time of denial to the time of disconnection. We're disconnected our actions from what we think is the right thing to do. And the second thing is we have to save ourselves from ourselves. So those two linguistic changes really help people to start to act differently.
So this is a philosophical question more so than a technical question. Do you think it's possible to have a high quality of life as well as reduce carbon emissions?
Oh, of course. No question. You know,
and I ask that question because frequently people will say things like, well, you know, is it right for us to deny, you know, people who are in a less developed part of the world the same quality of living that we have historically had in the U.S. or Western Europe, for example? And I've heard that argument before to stop short action on climate change. In other words, it's an inevitability, and we can't have a high quality of life as well as deal with the climate. You think that's nonsense, I bet.
Well, here's the context, the historical context. Post-World War II, we entered the Cold War. And America, in its marketing and media strength, realized it had to defeat the Soviet Union. So we make a big deal out of the American way of life. It's a highly materialistic, consumer-driven, freedom-driven culture. And we were very good at exporting that around the world. You know, our media, our advertising was around the world. We sold the American way of life because we had to beat the Soviets. We beat the Soviets. Then, post-Cold War, everyone said, oh, I want to live the American way of life. And this was right around the time that we realized that the American way of life was very damaging to the planet. So first people said, well, so then the first wave was, well, you Indonesia, you Zimbabwe can't do that because now we know it's bad. And they've said, you know, to your question, well, how can you deny us the right? So the only way that I can think about solving that was what I wrote about with Bob Leonard as my co-author, Moving to a Finite Earth Economy, which was basically to say, take the top 20 GDPs in the world. Remember, there's 195 countries. Take the top 20 GDPs of the world, which represent 80% of all energy consumption. And just have those 20 move from 77% fossil fuel for source of energy down to 30% by 2030. And none of the other countries would have to make any change significantly. So those that have created the problem must lead both morally and with their aggregate economic weight to solve the problem. So if every person on Earth lived at the level of Americans, we'd have to have five Earths to supply us. So China, if everybody lived as people in China do, we'd only have to have one Earth, but that's a per capita measurement. So the bottom line is, yeah, we can do it, but we have to, those that pollute the most have to do all of the solving of the problem. And those are the, except for India, which is the third worst polluter on a per capita basis, it's not affluent. But basically, that's the solution. That's how you get to climate justice.
I like it. So in your presentation, in a leap year look at climate change, you had a very interesting set of things each of us may do to alter the rate of change of the climate warming. Quote to us some of those things, because I find that list extremely helpful and beneficial, especially vis-a-vis what you said in terms of we have to change to crew consciousness.
Lists of what people can do?
Right, yeah. So number one was a very unpopular choice, which was have one less child.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, that's, you know, the the three things that I have chosen to take on, because I realize that most climate change books are avoiding them, are the difficult topics, which is have fewer children. In other words, we're close to 8 billion people. That in 1950, there were 3 billion. So in 70 years, we have increased that by our population by 267%. And it shows that the carbon emissions has increased the same amount. So the one thing we need to do is to choose to have fewer children. The goal, I wrote my book, 6 billion, but I was nervous about that. And as you know, Chris Tucker at our symposium said 3 billion. So we need to reduce population. That is the alternative is we don't survive as a species. So do we intentionally have fewer children to bring the population down this century? Or do we not care and probably end up with the same number, but a lot of it through violent deaths for fighting over water, food, air, land, whatever? So that's one.
I'm going to pause you right there just because for the audience, you didn't put numbers to that, but from your presentation, having one less child actually has a 15x benefit, yes, in terms of carbon emissions. The number two thing, 15 times. Like you could do nothing else other than have one less child, and you have made a huge impact.
Yeah, it's 53. The average American is responsible for 16 tons of CO2 emissions every year. The average of the planet per capita is 4 tons, including us, into that average. To have a child is 52 tons in the aggregate, because you divide it between yourself and your spouse and the number of children, number of grandchildren, down through great-grandchildren. And so just just that genetic extension is 53 tons. I think the next biggest one was something like 2 tons or 2.5. And that's what usually people think. Oh, get an electric car. Oh, don't fly. Oh, have a autoless life. Oh, right. All of those added up, the next 7 added up, come to about half of not having a child. So that is significant. The other thing is, you know, when I say simply, when people get depressed about this who are new to thinking about this, I say, just do one thing. Not having a child is the biggest thing you can do. But if you don't recycle, recycle. If you don't ride share, ride share. If you have a car or a truck that's got low gas mileage, turn it in and get a used car that's got a higher gas mileage. And just do one thing. It's just like, you know, 20 years ago, a random act of kindness. You do one random act of kindness, it makes you feel good, so you do another one. So I know people who've just started out by recycling everything, and they've gotten so into it, they're composting, they're only shopping at used stores, they never buy new anything, you know, and it just, it increases. But you got to start somewhere. Everybody needs to do just one thing, and that will lead to another until you get to the bigger ones that we're talking about. But starting to have, there's several, I'd say probably half a dozen millennial, you know, couples in their 20s and 30s that have made conscious decisions to not have children. And though a lot of it's lifestyle and profession, inevitably, every single one said, well, I don't know if I want to bring a child into this world. I mean, it's just where there's too many people already, and that's triggered climate change. I mean, the reality, Jason, is we could all live at the consumptive, throwaway, disposable, pollute the air level we're living if there was 2 billion of us. But there's 4 times as many. So we can't. I mean, we've birthed ourselves and bought ourselves into this problem.
Indeed. So for my last question, actually 2 questions. What isn't being talked about that ought to be relative to climate change?
The understanding that the difficult things have to be embraced. Having fewer children, using nuclear power, which is much safer than fossil fuels, and starting to plan for what is about to happen. It's estimated that between 30 and 100 million climate refugees between 2020 and 2030. I added up the 6 biggest migrations in human history, and all of them together over centuries is around 50 million, which is the average of the next 10 years. So strategic retreat. Where are the 4 million people in Miami going to live in 2040 when they won't be able to live there? So strategic retreat, nuclear power totally embraced, and having fewer children. Those are the 3 big things that must be faced individually and collectively.
And my final question, what question do you wish I had asked you?
It's a hard one. You've asked some pretty good questions. I think I will come back to language. If everybody says we need to save ourselves from ourselves, they see into the problem, which is we have gone through the last 50 years with no consequence to our actions. We have consumed without knowing the consequence. We are in siloed thinking. So once we accept the fact that this existential problem has been of our own creation, then we have to solve it or not. As my colleague Tim Rummage always says, once we do a presentation and give up this information, now that you know, what you're going to do. So now that climate change is real, we're in the fight or flight stage, it's happening all around the world every single day, every single hour, what are you going to do?
David, thanks so much for joining us today. For those of you tuning in the audience, you can find all of our podcasts at sarasotainstitute.global. We, of course, would love to make you a member of the organization. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please go back to where you downloaded this podcast to find another one that might be of interest to you. Thank you.